Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in this week for Scott Schaefer. And we're in Sacramento, where lawmakers have wrapped up their two-year legislative session last night.
Guy was watching until the bitter end, which came a little before 1 a.m., as was our first guest, Politico Playbook California co-author Lara Corti. A bit later, we'll also be joined by Jessica Moore. She's Deputy Secretary for Forest and Wildland Resilience. She's going to talk about how this heat wave could impact wildfire season and what progress the state has made around preventing and battling blazes. Some of that may have come last night.
But first, Lara Corti from the illustrious Political Playbook. Welcome to The Breakdown.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for doing the playbook so we know what's going on the days that we're not paying as close attention.
Hey, just doing my duty.
All right. Well, it was, as it always is, a marathon ending. I always say lawmakers are like college students. They never do anything until They absolutely have to.
Mm-hmm.
Although as journalists, yeah, we shouldn't really like throw stones, right? I would say one of the biggest kind of packages that came through is actually something that only came up in the last few weeks of session. This was Governor Gavin Newsom's climate package. And the kind of centerpiece is $54 billion in climate spending and keeping the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant on. Lara, tell us first, how did this all come together, and like any sense of why Newsom waited until the 11th hour?
Yeah, I mean, nobody can, you know, look into the governor's mind, but we know what's going on, right? There's record heat waves happening. I mean, we're still in a drought. We just had this big national conversation about water shortages in the West. And so, you know, about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, Newsom started showing up to the legislature, going to the caucuses and the Senate.
Which is rare. We should tell people. Like,
yeah,
the governor
doesn't deign
to like go upstairs or come down.
Especially now that the offices are like, you know,
so far away. Yeah.
Yeah. So Newsom made the very bold choice of coming to talk to the lawmakers and say, hey, here's my plan. We need to get this stuff done. And, you know, I think a big part of this, you can't overstate how important it is to keep the electrical grid functioning. That was a big liability for Gray Davis in 2003 that led to his recall. That was ultimately successful. So you have to keep the lights on, and things are getting really dire in California in terms of having enough energy. And so, but you also have the environmental advocates who are saying, like, yeah, we want to keep the lights on, but we're tired of using gas-powered plants. We want to switch over to green energy. But the state just doesn't have enough green energy to fill it right now. So Newsom had to do this thing of, kind of walking and chewing gum at the same time of figuring out how to make sure that the lights stay on while also fulfilling all these kind of promises and these obligations to push California towards a greener future. So that was really the big push in the last month.
Energy deregulation, also like a late night, last second California legislature special, kind of flashbacks there. But they couldn't have scripted a better night to vote on this bill, right? It was insanely hot outside. There were all these concerns over blackouts. And that's something that seemed to come up a lot from lawmakers, is saying, like, this is a perfect example of why we need something like Diablo Canyon, which provides, you know, 8% of the state's electricity.
Right.
And it's not affected by the wind, not affected by the sun.
Right. That's the big thing. So you're totally right. We're about to enter a heat wave that's going to be really bad. Gavin Newsom came out on Wednesday before lawmakers entered the last hours of the session and said, listen, we really need to be thinking critically about grid reliability, especially right now. And to your point about different sources of energy, Diablo is a nuclear power plant, which means it operates 24/7. And that's one of the liabilities of wind or solar, is that if the wind dies down or once the sun goes down, you lose that energy. And as it happens, people tend to really blast their ACs or use their dishwasher or their ovens after the sun goes down.
Right.
So that's when the grid gets really stressed. So that was the argument that the administration had for wanting to keep the nuclear power plant extended towards till 2030.
Right. I mean, we did see one bill fail in this package. It would have sped up the targets for reducing greenhouse gases with a 2030 deadline. We also saw, you know, a lot of consternation among environmental activists around not just Diablo, but this carbon capture plan that essentially allows oil companies to sort of offset their emissions, right, by putting carbon back in the ground. And to me, both Diablo and that kind of speak to like the challenge that I think people who support renewable energy are in, which is that there's downsides to a lot of this stuff, right? And we probably will need carbon capture in the long term, but you know, advocates for climate change and environmentalists say, well, this is a giveaway to oil industries. I'm just curious, like, what you guys see as where fossil fuel stands politically in California after this session and just in this moment. Laurie, go for it.
That's a great question. I think that fossil fuel, to a certain degree, understands they see the writing on the wall, right? California is one of the most ambitious governments in this space of wanting to transition to clean energy. But the reality is that the state still very much relies on fossil fuels to keep the power going. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the idea of totally abandoning fossil fuel right now, I think, or even the Diablo Canyon power plant right now, is not super feasible. But to your point, this is the same thing with carbon capture. Environmental advocates just want to make sure that this idea of maintaining access to power isn't going to take the place of switching to green energy. They're worried that lawmakers or the administration is going to use this as kind of an excuse to not bring renewable energy online.
Right.
So that's their main concern.
And Guy, I mean, we've been watching at KQED, one of our colleagues, some of the bills that died, which would have sort of increased penalties for oil refineries that pollute and harm the communities around them. What's your take?
Right. I mean, that was axed even, you know, pre-last night. That was in appropriations. But I think, look, one thing you see is Democrats have enough of a buffer in their votes in the legislature, certainly in the assembly, where they can lose a lot of Central Valley members, Democrats. I was watching two
from
of them
oil,
last night, Adam Gray, Rudy Salas, both running for Congress, both huge hopes for the party if they're going to keep the House and keep, you know, winning seats in California. They're okay to have them not support these bills. And in fact, it was beyond climate bills. Those two weren't supportive of gun legislation last night. They were basically...
But that's good politics, right? If you think about it, if Dems have the votes, why put your members up to a tough vote that could, you know,
show up in
hurt your chances to take back Congress, which ultimately would have far more impact on, you know, the nation's ability to kind of, and the world's ability to tackle pollutants.
Right. Well, and you say it right. It's a worldwide issue. And I think that gets back to the Diablo conversation. Is this, so many countries are grappling with this question of nuclear power and the need to just supplant what we have coming from solar and wind with a more reliable source. We were talking about this earlier. Even Japan, which went through that incredible nuclear disaster a decade ago, is now starting to bring back nuclear plants online, which is, you know.
And there, we should say, I mean, this is, there are huge safety questions. There's a lot of work that needs to be done at Diablo, which is the whole reason for this package.
I think my question is more like, why did this come so late in the game when for years we've heard this exact commentary from, you know, energy climate advocates saying we need this power long term. We can't afford to have this close in a few years.
It is really interesting to me. I mean, we've known for, I'm thinking about gas powered plants, right? There's several that are going offline that are scheduled to go offline in the next couple of years. And environmental advocates say, like, we've known this for a decade that we're phasing this stuff out. And when we talk about right now, when you hear Democrats say, like, oh, we need to rely on Diablo because there's been supply chain issues and there's COVID-19. We knew about this way before the pandemic. Yeah. And so I think environmental advocates are really frustrated. They're like, you keep, you know, pushing it down the field. Let's get something going.
But I mean, that speaks to the politics, like the reality of politics, right? And I think that one reason I would think, I mean, besides just the broader sort of what's happening in the news that might wait is like, these are controversial issues. And the less time you have for people to lobby against them, like the more likely you are to pass them. All right, well, let's switch gears. We've talked about the environmental stuff, climate change, abortion, obviously a huge political issue heading into the midterms. California's all in on protecting abortion rights. There's a measure on the ballot for voters to enshrine it in the Constitution. But we also saw a big package pass. It included $20 million to expand access to reproductive care in LA, allow trained nurse practitioners to perform first trimester abortions. Another one that offers legal protections to people who travel here to perform or get abortions. And then I think the most controversial was this one that bars coroner investigations when a fetus dies. Mm-hmm. What was the conversation like in the legislature, Laura? Like, was this even that like controversial among this very heavily Democratic body?
I mean, I would say no. I think there's, you'd be hard pressed to find another issue in California where the advocates slash lobbyists are as lockstep with the legislature and the administration as abortion. I mean, we saw immediately after Roe v. Wade was overturned, you had the president of Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California standing with the governor, with the first partner, saying we're going to take action. There was this package of 14 bills related to abortion rights, you know, everything from funding for information, from protecting people from out of states, from being prosecuted for coming here for abortion. And no, I think that it passed relatively easily. This is kind of a slam dunk for Democrats. It's going to make a big difference in a couple of close state races this year. It's definitely going to turn out more voters. This is, as far as I think, you know, just the start. They wanted to show their gravitas in this area to the world, and they definitely did.
Well, and it's like a win-win for the governor, right? Because he gets to kind of beat his chest, and they're actually doing some things that they all agree with.
Right. One thing I was thinking about last night, Laura, is how many lawmakers for whom last night was the final end of session. There's people termed out, leaving because of redistricting. What's your sense of how that affected all the business that happened in the Capitol over the last week?
Yeah, I mean, when you're on your way out the door, you kind of get to do whatever you want, right? Without worrying about who you're going to make angry. The area where this seemed most apparent to me was the failure of a bill to let the legislative staff unionize. That made it through the Senate earlier this session, and then it went to the Public Employment and Retirement System Committee in the assembly. And Chair Jim Cooper, who is actually out this year, he is running for sheriff in Sacramento. He originally tried to pull that bill. He didn't want to have it heard. But then after some pressure from, I believe, the speakership's office, did end up letting it be heard. And it died in committee. And some of the no votes on it were people who were leaving this year. And that was really consequential. You know, we're going to have a whole new class of legislators coming in the fall. That's going to play into the ongoing speaker fight, which is not going to die anytime soon. So,
yeah, that'll be fascinating. Well, in the meantime, we will all be all eyes on Governor Newsom. He's got, you know, 30 days to sign or veto most of these bills. One we didn't mention that's a huge one is creating this fast food sort of franchise framework so that there's, you know, wages and job protections are kind of the same across a lot of, you know, these low wage industries. Guy, I know you've talked a lot about that bill. Is that one you're watching?
I mean,
like,
that,
what are you
to me,
for?
That seems right. Like one of the big ones to watch where we maybe haven't gotten such a signal from the administration. There were some concerns that the Department of Finance raised throughout the process, but that seems like a big one to watch over the next 30 days.
So Senator Shannon Grove said McDonald's came to her office and said they will leave California if this bill passes. Do you guys think that's going to happen?
No, because they're franchises. I don't know that that's up to McDonald's. I
mean, I'll drive to Nevada for McDonald's.
you heard it here. All right. I wouldn't cry, I guess, personally.
More
I
of
had a
McDonald's
burger on a road trip for recently, and my husband and I were like, why do we let the kids pick? No, but I think, you know, there's also always going to be sort of smaller issues. I mean, we know that there's been a lot of speculation that the governor, say, vetoed that safe injection site bill because of potential presidential ambitions.
Sure.
Anything else, Laura, before we go, that, like, you're like, oh, this could be really sticky for Newsom, or that, you know, you think...
No, I mean, the big ones were the things that he was championing, right? The safe injection sites was probably the most controversial. The other controversial bill by, you know, Scott Wiener about letting minors of a certain age get vaccinated without their parents' protection. I think that might have been a little bit sticky for him, but Scott ended up pulling that before it even got a vote, saying they didn't have the vote. So,
all right. Well, they'll be back next year, I'm sure, trying on that. All right. We are going to let Laura Corti go. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
So much. Good talking to you guys.
When we come back, we're going to be joined by Jessica Morris. She is Deputy Secretary for Forest and Wildland Resilience. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I am Marisa Lagos here with Guy Marzorati, and we are thrilled to welcome Jessica Morse. She ran for Congress in 2018 and is now Governor Gavin Newsom's Deputy Forest and Wildland Resilience Secretary. Jessica, welcome to the Breakdown.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to get into your family's history and all the work you're doing now around wildfires, but it feels like we should start with this heat wave, right? We're seeing high temperatures, low humidity, I think some scary conditions for people just in terms of staying safe. But what is the fire risk? What are you watching this weekend and in the coming days?
Absolutely. I mean, the extreme heat across the entire state is a major fire risk for California. And what we're going to see is the fire risk increase over the coming weeks following it. What's functionally happening is that there's a giant kiln drying out all of the dead fuel on the ground, all of the grasses, and it's drying it to really low moisture conditions. And so what that means is when a fire starts, it moves fast and hot, just like if you had dry firewood. Mm-hmm. We saw similar conditions to this prior to the Creek Fire in 2020, where we had high tree mortality. We had record-setting heat. Remember, that's when Death Valley clocked in at 130 degrees. The following week, we had a fire break out around Shaver Lake called the Creek Fire, which then it burned at such high intensity because the fuel was so dry and there was so much wood on the ground that it created that 50,000-foot pyrocumulus, really dynamic, difficult conditions.
That was one where hikers had and campers had to be.
Exactly. Yeah, you had people evacuated by the National Guard in extreme conditions at Huntington Lake there. Gratefully, we had no fatalities in that fire. But what happens is when the fuel, when there's a lot of fuel on the ground and it's really dry, then that's where you get these extreme fire behaviors and the fires start to create their own weather systems, which then causes what we saw on this fire or the McKinney fire earlier this summer, where that column went 50,000 feet in the air. It comes down like a splat. Mm. And so then you end up with hurricane force winds driving a fire front in every single direction. So the fire doesn't have then one front. It's a radius. And so that makes it incredibly hard to contain and to fight. So that's some of the conditions that we're concerned about. Those dry fuel loads that we're going to see from this heat wave make firefighting conditions on the ground much more unpredictable and more difficult.
Well, we'll be safe out there, everyone camping.
Right, and it sounds like in the coming weeks too, right? You really need to keep an eye out.
It's now going to be this level of moisture, of dry fuel from being dried out until we get significant rain. And so we'll be very vulnerable if there's dry lightning or human-caused fires.
Right.
Well, 95% of the fires in California are actually caused by people. And sometimes it's deliberate. We had 108 arson arrests this year.
Wow.
And sometimes it's unintentional. You know, it's somebody dragging a chain when they are off-roading, or somebody's car, you know, backfiring along a road and igniting the grasses along the side of the road. So, or somebody having a gender reveal party. So it's important that people are really alert to their actions and that they're not creating sparks. Cal Fire has a One Less Spark campaign, so I'd encourage everyone to go check out Cal Fire's website. You guys can link to it and get pro tips on how to keep your family safe.
Well, as Marisa mentioned, your family history goes way, way back in California. We're talking like covered wagons, right?
Yes. Yes. My my great-great-grandparents came over in covered wagons in the late 1800s and landed in the town of Gold Run. And so we still have that original homestead in the family today. They were actually train people when they first came. So they, my great-great-grandmother manned the telegraph booth at Donner Pass in the early 1800s.
Wow.
She sat there alone and, you know, at the top of the pass with a little, you know, a little tote in her gun. And she was a very sort of, they were very kind of wild, wild west type of folks who really, yeah, who created a lovely legacy for our family today.
And you guys still have that homestead in your family. I'm curious though, like When you sat down, I assume you might have interviewed with the governor. Did you guys talk about that? Because I know he spent a lot of time in like Dutch Flat with his dad and extended family.
Yeah, when I first met him when I was running for Congress, I mentioned the Dutch Flat Gold Run connection, and he was floored. And then I immediately started policy wonking on him about how we can tackle the bark beetle pandemic. And that's, I think, what caught his attention.
Right. He likes a policy wonk conversation for sure. So you actually grew up, though, in the suburb of Carmichael. Mm-hmm. Outside of Sacramento, where we are. How did you, like, as a kid and growing into your adult years, like, stay connected with that family homestead?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we went up there, and we were also very big outdoors people. And so we were always backpacking, hiking, fishing. My dad's a big hunter, so I'd go hunting with him up in the Sierras and the mountains. And so we always kept that sort of deep Sierra connection in addition to just visiting family on the homestead itself. But, yeah, we were big, big backpackers.
You're a big hiker, right?
Yeah, I'm a big hiker. And so that was kind of our family tradition. I think my first backpacking trip was when I was 9 in Mount Lassen. And so we camped and hiked all over the Sierra. And so as a young adult, that really became ingrained in me. And I became just a big solo backpacker. And that's just a big part of my identity, really regenerate and rejuvenate in the mountains.
Got to tell my 9-year-old it's time to get out there on the trail, right, man.
Well, carry their own sleeping bag. Yeah. They can do it.
It seems like service was really an emphasis in your childhood and kind of carried as a through line into your career as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, my mom always had us out doing service projects in the community growing up and, you know, everything from, you know, sort of helping with like church help and also families in need. And then I spent a lot of my sort of high school years helping at-risk youth and teaching them to appreciate mountains. And so then when I was in college, I discovered, you know, foreign aid and really had the sense of how to help the world globally and really loved sort of that commitment to public service.
Yeah, tell us what you did. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
Oh,
start
yeah.
to your career.
It was really phenomenal. My first job at, I mean, startling. I wouldn't necessarily give this as good advice for future youth of America, but my first job out of college, I joined USAID and within 6 months, they sent me to Baghdad. And this was 2005. And so it was at the height of the war.
What
and
was
so,
your family's reaction to that?
I told my mom that this was for her own spiritual growth.
So you spent several years abroad. What did you learn from that time? Like, what are you bringing back to your service here?
You know, I learned to think in terms of systems because I started recognizing and understanding working on foreign aid in Iraq versus, you know, national security strategy in India. What I saw was the need to have systemic change as opposed to individual change. And so I've always been really fascinated by saying, what's the root of the problem and how do we get at that? So, for example, in college, I was in Ethiopia and I was volunteering with Save the Children during what was a green famine. So it had rained. It just was, there just wasn't any infrastructure to be able to collect the water. So the crops didn't grow properly. So everybody was starving, even though there had technically been enough rain. Right. And so what they started identifying was that people in Ethiopia didn't have individual land ownership. And so they had no incentive to put in water catchment and irrigation to improve the land to be drought resilient. Mm. And so what they did is they created these, they started solving it from that standpoint of how do we give people land titles that they then have an incentive to start making those improvements and use that to gain access to capital. And it really made a big difference. You didn't start seeing famine in Ethiopia again until now, which is more war conflict driven as opposed to infrastructure driven. And so for me, that was a really sort of important lesson. I mean, just countless lessons like that throughout my career that really started having me ask these deep questions about what's the systemic problem in the spider web that needs to get addressed where a government intervention could help versus a private intervention.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown on KQED. We're talking with Jessica Morse, Deputy Secretary for Forest and Wildland Resilience in the Newsom administration. Some folks in Northern California might recognize your name. You ran for Congress in 2018. You lost to Tom McClintock in that race. Looking back, like, what did you make of that experience? What did you learn from that?
Oh, it was a great experience. It was a lovely way to serve my community at a time when it just felt like we were on a political precipice. You know, I had always been in public service. I hadn't been all that interested in politics because I really like getting deep into a problem set. And but when I started seeing my own community in the Sierra and Northern California start to go down a path that felt like it was the representation in 2018 just felt like we were having votes that were actually against our community. People were voting against rural health care. There was votes against rural broadband, against fire resilience. And I thought this is too important of a moment in our history for me to stand by. And so I dropped my life and moved home and thought, I wonder if I can run for Congress because, you know, how do you start a congressional campaign from scratch? And again, not great advice that I would give to everyone. But what I did that was really foundational for me is I did a listening tour for 3 months across the 10 counties of our district to not only understand, because it was clear that the national dynamics were really difficult right after Trump was elected, but then I wanted to understand what the local dynamics were. How are these national policies impacting my community? How would better representation improve California's Sierra Nevada communities? And so I went across 10 counties and listened to the real experts, the local officials on the ground, local nonprofit leaders, and really spoke to people who were trying to tackle problems. And so started hearing the real need for real substantive solutions. And so that gave me that foundation and confidence that I needed to serve at home and that our community deserved somebody pushing for better policies and better solutions. And so I ran, and a huge part of my platform was wildfire solutions.
Well, yeah, let's get into that because that is now your job, and you really came into it in the thick of a very challenging time for the state. And, you know, I feel like there's the long-term stuff. There's the climate change that, you know, the legislature just passed a huge package and are trying to tackle. But to your point, on the ground, what's immediately important to people is being able to protect their communities and homes. Mm-hmm. I guess, where do you think we stand? I mean, after, I feel like 2017 was really a big wake-up call for folks, but we're still in this mega drought. What do you see as the biggest wins and challenges right now in this moment?
Absolutely. So the advantage of the fire crisis is that it is solvable, and we actually know what to do. And we are starting to see our investments and the strategic shift that we've taken in California since 2018 start to pay off dividends. The challenge is that the crisis is also accelerating. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, can our interventions and our mitigation efforts actually keep pace with the change in the climate crisis? Let me give you a couple examples, right? So if you look at trend lines in fire, none of these are going to be straight, right? But the general trend since 2018 is downwards in terms of loss of life, loss of homes, and communities protected. And that is a direct result of better fire suppression response, as well as a much more comprehensive approach to wildfire resilience. And I can talk through what we mean by wildfire resilience, because that's often a generic term.
Unfortunately, we're short on time. But what would you say is the biggest element of that that's really is making a difference?
There's three fronts to it. So we are protecting, we are restoring natural fire intervals to wide landscapes. So we have to do by hand what 100 years of fire should have done. Mm-hmm. We're then putting in strategic fuel breaks around communities. That gives firefighters a tactical advantage during a firefight. Like we saw in the Caldor fire, flames went from 150 feet down to 15 feet when they hit the fuel breaks. And that's why South Lake Tahoe is standing today.
Right.
And then we're also hardening homes and communities so that you have actually, so that when embers are crashing in on homes, they're less likely to ignite. And then you're not going to see an infiltration like you saw in Paradise where the fires went house to house. So those three together give you fire resilience. One of those alone is helpful, but banana. Three together is what is actually having us, you know, we have 200,000 acres burned this year versus 2.2 million the same time last year.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but that's a good note to end on. Jessica Morris, Deputy Director of Forest and Wildfire Resilience, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's going to be it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. Guy's our producer, and our engineer is Katie McMurrin. Have a good one.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.